Okay, we're live. Let's just give Jack a minute to come back in. He's copying something, I think. All right. Good morning, everybody, and welcome to the first monthly meeting of 2017 of the District of Columbia Board of Ethics and Government Accountability. My name is Robert Spagnoletti. I'm chair of the board, and we are joined today by all of our board members. Ms. Schwartz is joining us by phone, but she's already dialed in and plugged in. So we have a complete quorum. We are located here at room 540 South at 1 Judiciary Square, which is our usual meeting place, and we are being recorded on our system here. An agenda was posted in accordance with the Open Meetings Act. Are there any changes or amendments to the agenda before we get started?
Not on our side.
No? Okay. So hearing none, we'll just adopt the one that was posted by consensus. And we'll go ahead to the report by the Director of Open Government, Ms. Hughes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The Office of Open Government received on November 1st, 2016, an Open Meetings Act complaint number OOG0007, alleging the Cross-Sector Collaboration Task Force failed to post meetings that occurred in October 2016 and that were to occur in November 2016 and January of 2017. The OOG issued an opinion on December 21st, 2016, resolving the complaint. OOG found the task force failed to comply with timely notice and recording requirements. I will, however, note that the task force has been and continues to be fully willing to comply with the requirements of the Open Meetings Act. The violations that the Office of Open Government found were due in large part to technical difficulties in publishing to the Deputy Mayor for Education website and the use of conference call recording options. The Deputy Mayor's office has responded to the opinion, indicating measures it has taken to come into compliance at the direction of the Office of Open Government. This is yet another example of the need for mandatory posting to the central calendar to minimize the technical challenges that have hampered the task force. So I will continue to press forward with hopefully reintroduce legislation that would make at minimum publishing mandatory to the central calendar.
I'm glad they're cooperative, though.
They are, yeah, very.
Good.
As a result of the audit the Office of Open Government conducted in the last quarter of 2016, we issued an opinion finding the Commission on African Affairs has failed to comply with meeting notice and recording requirements of the OMA. That opinion is numbered OOG 0006, and it was issued on December 12, 2016. Both of the opinions, of course, are on the Office of Open Government website. Since the last board meeting, the Office of Open Government has responded to 6 requests for FOIA advice and 9 requests for Open Meetings Act advice. The enforcement action against the Mayor's Advisory Commission on Caribbean Community Affairs, that is ongoing. The status hearing has been continued until February 10th. It had been scheduled for this week. Trainings. The office conducted a FOIA training with the Office of Unified Communications and the Office of Administrative Hearings on December 6th. And that concludes the update.
Pretty busy for a holiday month.
Indeed.
Good. Well, thank you. Any questions? No? All right. Well, thank you, Ms. Hughes.
Welcome.
And now for the report by the Director of Government Ethics, Mr. Sobin.
Good morning, everybody, and welcome and happy new year. Start right off with the statistics. So last month, in the last 3 months, we've made serious headway into reducing our investigation caseload. We currently opened one investigation in this previous month. The prior month was also one. In November, we had opened 3. We were actually able to close 5 investigations during this month. Last month, we closed 10, and we closed 6 in November. And what that's done is it's given us our lowest caseload so far, since we've been in operation. We now have 5 open where we had 9 open last month, and the previous month in November we had 18. Now that's not to say that we're not going to suddenly get hit with a bunch of complaints, because as you know, we have 21 cases stayed or inactive, and the vast majority of those come from one investigation being conducted by the Inspector General,
right?
Which we think are all going to hit at the same time. So even though we have a slight lull, we're expecting a big increase, probably in the next month.
And you're in regular communication with the Inspector General's office, right?
We are.
Okay.
We continue to have our monthly meetings where we go over joint cases, cases in which we are standing down, cases in which they're standing down, and it's actually working very well. We have a full agenda that we share 2 days before the meetings.
Great.
All right, our publication and reporting obligations. The best practices report has been issued and distributed. Our quarterly complaint report has been published. Both documents are in the Dropbox and available to the public on our website.
Has there been any reaction or response to the BPR, by the way? I know it's a holiday and the thing is due on December 31st, so no one's around to react, much less. And it's only been, a week, but.
Yeah, it hasn't. Nothing's been directed to me. I don't know, right. Mr. Grimaldi, nothing.
Okay. I mean, it's very early. I wasn't necessarily expecting anything.
Yep. All right, trainings attended by the staff. Our auditor, Ms. Olawamne, finished a series of classes necessary to retain her auditing credentials with her attendance at a 3-day critical thinking skills class offered by the Council of Inspectors General on Integrity and Efficiency, or what we call SIGI. General Counsel Flowers completed the EEO Counselor Officers Certification Program offered by the Office of Human Rights. Conducted by staff, we did 8. Not including one schedule with the Real Estate Commission that was canceled. The 8 included 2 new employee orientations, 2 MSS trainings, 1 general board and commission training, an abbreviated training session for the Commission on Arts and Humanities, and an internal training on our lobbyist system for staff who would be inheriting duties of our employee who is out on FMLA. We also, along with Attorney Grimaldi and General Counsel Flowers, attended the Council of Government Ethics Laws, or COGL, the annual conference, which was held last month. The conference generally covered new developments in the fields of campaign finance, governmental ethics, elections, lobbying, and even some freedom of information. Item D, advisory opinions and advice. We issued 32. Since the last meeting, which was down from 58 the previous month, owing mostly to the holidays, I believe. Additionally, we responded to more than a dozen queries related to the impending lobbyist registration and lobbyist activity report filing deadlines. That number grows every day since we are now in the middle of it.
Are you bracing yourself?
Thankfully, we have our staff who are providing great customer service, getting back to people very quickly. On December 23rd, we published a sua sponte advisory opinion on social media, which is in draft form and by law must be published in the DC Register for a 30-day period before it is finalized. Comments are due by January 23rd. This is the same opinion we discussed at the last month's meeting,
right.
Prior to publication. Ethics legislation and the Comprehensive Code of Conduct, best practices report, as we mentioned, was timely delivered on December 30th, the so-called New Year's Eve report, and copies will be provided to new council members, Gray and Trayon White. And speaking of new council members, the new council was sworn in on Monday, January 2nd. We have a new committee chair on our oversight committee, council member Charles Allen from Ward 6, who has assumed the chairmanship of the Committee on Public Safety and the Judiciary. The committee liaison, Kate Mitchell, fortunately, will be staying on with the committee, which is good for our plan to reintroduce the Comprehensive Code of Conduct. Mr. Grimaldi has circulated a draft version of the revised bill, which died when the last council ended. The revised bill would have reestablished the CCC, and so I'm going to let him bring you up to date on what our plans are on that.
Okay. Mr. Grimaldi.
Carol, have you been hearing all of this well enough?
Oh, yes, perfectly, okay. Actually.
Good. Okay. Good. All right. In terms of the legislation, getting back to Kate, I agree with Director Sobin. It is good news that she's staying on with the committee. There's at least one person then who's got familiarity with this beast, and I think that'll help grease the wheels. I have a call into her because in an exchange of emails with Director Sobin, she again stated that she was going to check with Councilmember McDuffie to see if he was going to reintroduce the bill himself. Point of procedure next Tuesday, the 10th, is the council's first legislative meeting of this new period. So it, in theory, could come as early as next Tuesday. I followed up with a call to Kate wanting to know what it would look like. Is he going to simply refile what we filed in 2015
right.
or some version of that? I haven't heard back from her.
Okay.
On a related government ethics front, I've been in touch with Councilmember Nadeau's staff, and they will be reintroducing their bill, which also left. That's Bill 21-124. And that bill had included a number of provisions, recommendations that we had made in, I believe, the 2014
Team BPR. Right. That's right.
So they have asked us to comment on that lapsed bill and get back to them because it looks like they're going to be reintroducing themselves. So just to give you a better idea of where I'm heading with all of this, you have the red line version that reflects through this past June comments, concerns that we had that people either brought to our attention or we just discovered ourselves through everyday kind of experience. My plan now, and I believe Carol may want to speak to this too, is to incorporate, just to be safe, the provisions in the Nadeau bill.
Right.
And if you'll recall, I think I mentioned this last time, a bill, 21-332, was passed that, among other things, makes semi-annual public financial disclosures required for certain council members and council employees. So it's now the law. They
right.
amended the Ethics Act to do that, and I think and we spoke favorably, generally, the board did, on that legislation. So I'm going to incorporate those new provisions into the draft as well.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. Because I mean, the whole idea of the comprehensive code was to take those disjointed pieces and put them together, so it doesn't make sense to leave them out even if they're marching through in separate bills at the moment. So that sounds great. And we spoke, Mr. Grimaldi and I spoke offline about trying to set up a time to go meet with now Chairman Allen to give him kind of an overview of where we are, what we're doing, the CCC, the status of that kind of stuff. Just, you know, an introductory meeting now that he's new, our new committee chair, and since we'll be seeing him in hearings next month.
Right, right.
So.
Right, right. Bob?
Yes.
Carol, I think it's a good idea for you to meet with the new chair, and the only, I don't know if this is a time for discussion of the red line version, is it, or if not, I'll wait.
I mean, if there's a particular thing, I do think that we will get a more comprehensive red line when Jack gets the other pieces put in, so we could probably have a more fulsome discussion then. But I know you've spoken with him directly about a couple of things, so maybe.
But the only one I'm going to repeat, because the other one I think he took care of because it's now the law. And, so, you know, that's one of those that's already part of it. And it's, because it covers only a few who make good salaries, I don't mind. That was that honorarium related to $10,000. And I think that's fine when we had further discussion about it. The one that I'm concerned a little about, though, that I think we should, because we have it in our red line version, is the one where that relates to defining a candidate. In it, we said that we're basically exempting people who are testing the waters, quote, you know, testing the waters, which would be those exploratory committees. And I think exploratory committees are oftentimes used by those who are certainly intending to run, but as a way, I never use one, by the way, so I can speak purely about them, even though it was available to me to use every time, is that you can then kind of circumvent the campaign law by saying it's an exploratory committee, and you can then bypass the minimum that can be raised. So, I mean, you know, the maximum. I'm still mean the minimum. The maximum that can be raised per person or per organization or company. And therefore, I think by putting in our red line version, a definition of candidate would be exempting those who do this. I think maybe only encourage it, because now it would then have the ethics board, the Board of Ethics and Government Accountability stamp of approval on them. And I've always thought they were questionable anyway. They do have to report, even though they can report far bigger contributions. And so my concern of putting it into our bill to be passed gives it a stamp of approval it doesn't presently have, and I would question our doing that. And so I hope as we proceed with this red line version, we'll look specifically to that definition of candidate.
So I will defer to Mr. Grimaldi and Mr. Flowers, who probably know this way better than I do, but my recollection is that we are simply repeating the existing definition that already exists in, is it the Hatch Act or is it the local Hatch Act?
Well, that's essentially why, that's our only concern is the Hatch Act,
right.
Because that's the only thing
we have to enforce. Right. That's my recollection.
Right.
So I think what we'll do is we'll just, because it's one thing to codify in our comprehensive code what we're enforcing. It's another thing to change the organic definition of what it is and how it would impact the Hatch Act and everything else. So I do think that we will just double check and make sure that we've adopted the exact language of what that is. And if we think that an issue needs to be raised for, you know, and obviously we enforce the Hatch Act, but the campaign finance laws fall under the umbrella of the OCF. If there's something that needs to be discussed there about that or with the administration, obviously we can take that up as well. But for purposes of making the comprehensive code, all we're doing is folding in what already exists, I believe. Is that right?
Well, that's actually a good point she makes, because we do need to make sure that our redefining something doesn't have unintended consequences,
right,
like raising the limit for somebody.
Well, that's the whole thing. I mean, right. I want to make sure that we're
okay. So
yeah, that's one of my concerns. And I may be in our cover or when we do it, if we're just regurgitating present law, whether we like it or not, I do think maybe there should be asterisks or somewhere or something that says that, you know, some of this and is just putting, regurgitating, I'm sure this is a bit repeating, present law, and that does not mean that there's a buy-in by the Board of Ethics and Government Accountability of it.
Right.
I just think, you know, if we could... I just think it needs a discussion, and I'm glad to see that we'll have one. Thank you.
Right, no problem. And just, I will also just note that along with the bill itself, we do provide and have provided a side-by-side analysis of where all the provisions came from and how they landed in the Act, so which ones were changed, which were not changed, so that any council member or person in the administration could take a look at it and know easily what we've tinkered with and what we've simply adopted based on what was already in the statute of the regs. So that accompanies the bill itself.
Okay. As long as it's very, seeable, maybe an asterisk, maybe it is special areas where we want to draw attention to it instead of just having them go to the end notes and, you know, not be aware. Do you know what I mean? Something like that might help.
Okay. Sounds good.
Carol, you also had some thoughts about the timing of resubmitting.
Oh, yes. I think that I think, you know, of course we're willing, as you all did before in 2015, before I got there, and all, others before they got there as well, put it directly to the council. I think that it would be good, though, to see what happens in the first meeting, which is coming up soon, to see if council members McDuffie and Nadeau put their O-bill in, or, you know, with changes, and I know she's requested that you comment, Jack, but I think it might be good to let them take an action first. If they do not, I think we should be right there poised and ready to go for the next legislative session by having the chair submitted on our behalf, as you all did before.
Well, I think that's
that's
a good plan. So let's see what happens on Tuesday, and Jack's got calls in to find out what their intentions are. So maybe we'll get a little heads up before that too.
Okay. Thank you.
Right. Thanks.
All right. Moving on to item F, rulemaking. We were asked by the Department of Human Resources, and this sort of dovetails with the CCC discussion and somewhat because it's now become relevant since the CCC is, you know, died during the last council session. There is some movement to sort of, by any means necessary, start fixing some of these rules that we suggested be fixed in the CCC. And so the executive, through the Department of Human Resources, has drafted a rulemaking that adds the Attorney General, the Chancellor of the D.C. Public Schools, the Executive Director of the D.C. Public Library, and members of the State Board of Education to the list of those persons who are authorized to serve as an honorary chair or honorary member of a nonprofit entity's fundraising event in their respective capacities as specified in the provisions of the rulemaking. It also adds new provisions governing intimate, consensual, personal relationships. It adds it to the nepotism section of the DPM, or the District Personnel Manual. The DPM does not currently have such a broad provision with respect to who may serve as an honorary chair of a charitable fundraising committee, but it restricts its coverage to the mayor. The council code of The council code of conduct has a corresponding provision, word for word, that just simply replaces the word mayor with council members. And what these do is they allow the mayor and the council members to, again, become involved in these nonprofit fundraising activities when those activities would benefit the district in some way. We took a different position on personal relationships. The DCHR rulemaking defines an intimate relationship as a romantic or sexual association consented to between two persons. In section 223K of the Comprehensive Code of Conduct, we define personal interest to mean an interest that, while not directly financially advantageous, would cause a reasonable person with knowledge of the relevant facts to question the impartiality of the covered individual in a particular matter. Personal interests include, without limitation, benefits to the covered individual, benefits to immediate family members and affiliated organizations, including reputation or business goodwill, job or career advancement, close personal friendships, and memberships in groups and organizations. We don't necessarily see the two provisions as being in conflict with one another, and I recommend that we not oppose the DPM provisions. However, I also recommend, with respect to the fundraising portion of it, that a sentence be added to the fundraising provision that makes it clear that the provision itself does not authorize the solicitation or receipt of donations or contributions from prohibited sources. This is to prevent a recurrence of the situation we had with the chancellor of the D.C. public school system recently, who sought contributions from city contractors to a nonprofit that ultimately would re-donate the money to the district. We don't want to make it unreasonably restrictive for folks like the chancellor to go out and get people to contribute to DCPS. We also want to make clear that this provision does not allow it to be done through prohibited sources like contractors, because that goes too far. So that's going to be, unless the board disagrees, that's going to be my recommendation to the mayor's office and to DCHR.
Yeah, and I mean, I really do see this sort of as an interim measure pending the CCC, because I do think, I mean, put aside kind of the way that DCHR has constructed that definition, it really is, it's probably not the smoothest thing
right.
going. But yeah, I can personally live with it while the CCC is working its way through, at least give the flexibility to those, senior level.
I mean, the way I authored it in the CCC does a better job. Because it essentially recognizes the two types of entities, those that are closely affiliated
right.
with the district and its fundraising goals, and those that are just regular nonprofit do-gooding
right.
agencies.
We discussed this at length during the CCC process, both in terms of the organization and in terms of the definition of a personal interest. I mean, we worked very hard at trying to get our arms around that
right.
because of the consequences that it carries. So again, I see the DCHR rulemaking as an interim measure for now, and I understand, I mean, to at least give them kind of quick and immediate flexibility, that's fine. And on the reporting side, like to report, like, I'm not exactly sure how you make an effort not to get involved in a relationship and that be a rule. I mean, it just seems to me to be a hard thing to enforce
right.
at the end of the day. That being said, I mean, I think that the failure to report the relationship of
right.
that nature is the more problematic issue, and that's...
It is interesting they would add it to the nepotism provision. So essentially what it says is you have to make a best effort, if you're a supervisor, not to engage in a romantic or sexual relationship with your subordinate. All right. We're not going to be able to enforce that.
That's not enforceable.
So, but what we can enforce is the failure to report that relationship once it occurs. I mean, we don't want to be the relationship police in the district, but failure to report is similar to the nepotism rule.
But for understandable reasons, I mean, if you're a supervisor and you're having a close sexual intimate relationship with one of your subordinates that maybe is not necessarily affecting the job itself, but everyone around them is going to know, or it's going to be found out, and it just opens up this awful can of worms about, you know, favoritism and getting benefits and conflicts of interest that at least if the next level supervisor is aware of, either, you know, a person could be, reassigned or a wall put in or, you know, safeguards put into place to prevent that kind of follow-up
right.
stuff that's going to happen. Cause I don't want to be part of the relationship police. I don't want to be delving in, you know, to everyone's personal business that is unrelated to an actual ethics violation. So
right.
that is an invitation to all kinds of, as some.
There's one thing that our general counsel pointed out too, which bears mentioning on what is the term? Baby mama or baby daddy?
Right. Where would that fit?
I don't think that would be captured by the new rulemaking. It would be captured by our personal interest rulemaking.
Right. Well, I mean, unless there was an ongoing relationship.
I mean, our statute.
Right. I mean, but...
Yeah, for the DCHR rulemaking, I think there would have to be
an
ongoing relationship.
Yeah.
So ours does a better job.
Right, in capturing all of this. No, I agree. But again, we're not forcing DCHR to adopt ours at this stage of the game, because it does have other ramifications in expanding that definition of personal interest, one that we've thought about and vetted in the context of the full CCC. But to do it on an ad hoc basis, first of all, we'll be then debating the very same thing that we debated in the CCC. But also, if what we're trying to do is get this particular rulemaking through so that these folks, the AG and everyone else, can do their, because it's part of the same rule, go ahead and start their honorary duties. We don't hold it up while we have this lengthy debate about personal interest. So.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, ma'am.
Yes, I wanted to say I'm glad that Darren brought forward that additional sentence. I had raised the same issue with Jack in a conversation with him after I had read the red line version and the other thing that was being considered, And so I was glad to see that it's going to speak directly to direct fundraising. It's one thing to have your name on a letterhead or something as an honorary chair, but it's another thing to be picking up and making phone calls to contractors, as Darren mentioned. And so I'm glad we're going to insert that sentence. I also think maybe given the discussion, Mr. Chairman, that we might want to say that interim somewhere, that we are, you know, not, you know, in any way, I think, you know, speaking, opposing this. We are not opposing this, and that it's fine as an interim, you know, or not fine. We don't want to maybe even give our stamp of approval, but not opposing it, with the understanding that it is an interim step until the CCC gets put into law, which we hope will be soon.
Yeah, I think we can. I think it's appropriate to recognize the fact that this would be addressed in a more fulsome way in the CCC, but that we can live with it the way it is. I think that's exactly right.
Fine, thank you.
Yep, will do.
Two somewhat related notes. Just keep in mind that there's a provision in the CCC that would repeal all of Chapter 18.
Right.
Okay. Yeah. A. And B, given the discussion, I think we should at least consider then when we revise the bill whether we want to make any changes to the nepotism provision.
To include that new relationship.
That
right.
Yep. Board Member Collier.
Regarding the honorary chair provision, consider whether, in addition to the sentence you proposed, also make clear that this change does not change any other laws with respect to compensation. The one question I had when I read that was, is it clear on its face
that the additional individuals can serve as honorary chair without compensation or personal
interest? They're not to receive honorariums or any type of compensation for this additional chair.
Sure. Well,
except for otherwise permitted, right? Because
I'm trying to think. It's never come up where, I mean, that would be, it's a good point. I mean,
yeah.
It's always been assumed that the mayor and the council members would never accept compensation to be an honorary board member. I think honorary sort of implies it, but it's probably a good point to make it clear it would never be for compensation because that would be a clear conflict of interest.
Right.
Okay.
Agree.
I'm sorry to interject. May I add something?
Yeah.
This rulemaking item was not on the agenda that was posted on the website. So if we can immediately remedy that, I'm more than happy to post
sure.
this and add a note.
Absolutely.
But I just
hold on just a second.
It's not on what was.
This is not a public. It's not. Hasn't been published yet.
I know, but it's a matter that's being discussed in the open portion of the
yeah.
meeting. So I'm just trying to keep us
okay.
with
yeah.
the agenda. That's all.
But that
yeah.
was another question I wanted to sort of raise. Our comments now would not be on the public record. Our comments to DCHR, and the question is, do we want to make these comments public as a part of the rulemaking process? Because now we're being asked to informally comment on the rulemaking.
Well, how if we do a letter, and then that letter will become part of the rulemaking record? I mean, I think that makes sense.
And we'll specifically ask that it be made a part of the record.
Yeah, absolutely.
The Chapter 18 back in 2014.
Right.
So I could send you at least in terms of format.
Yeah, sure. And we could add that one too. Okay.
Sounds great. Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Hughes.
Good resolution.
All right. Item G, budget. So tomorrow we have our budget request team meeting with the mayor's budget folks. We will make our best pitch for our budget enhancement, which is needed to cover both non-personal service expenditures, such as overhead and board member stipends, as well as personal service costs, which we hope this year will include an additional administrative employee to assist with lobbyist and FDS matters. Importantly, we have also asked for close to $1 million over 5 years as part of our capital budget plan to overhaul and maintain our FDS and lobbyist e-filing system, which will not only fix a myriad of ongoing technical and usability problems, but will keep us in compliance with cybersecurity measures imposed by the Office of the Chief Financial Officer. A representative from Okta has agreed to join us tomorrow in order to help us accurately describe precisely how dire the current situation has become with our e-filing system.
I received an invitation to go to that meeting as well, and I should be able to. I do have one little conflict I'm trying to resolve, but it's 11:30, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, I just received some news last night that we passed our final vulnerability test with Okta.
I saw that report by the skin of our teeth.
By the skin of our teeth. And again, it's a system being held together by bubblegum and chicken wire, as they say.
The thing that I found most interesting about this is the tolerance level for the error that they found, which is four. I don't know what that means because that doesn't tell you. But it just says, you know, we brought it in just under four,
right,
with the fixes that they made, which is great. But because you don't want Okta or the CFO's office shutting us down.
I mean, that's exactly what would have happened. We would have been shut down during the middle of our lobbyist registration activity report.
So I know it was a group effort by lots of folks to get it there. So we really appreciate that.
Was indeed. Staffing, I'm very pleased to introduce you to our temporary attorney, Ms. Asia Stewart Mitchell. Ms. Mitchell comes to us from the 7th Judicial Circuit of Maryland, where she served as a law clerk for the Honorable Tony Clark. She is a graduate of our own UDC David A. Clark School of Law and did her undergraduate work at Rutgers. Ms. Mitchell is filling in for Ms. Cooks, who is still out on FMLA leave until March. She is also assisting with lobbyists in FDS matters during Ms. Dillian's FMLA, which began just after the holiday.
Well, welcome.
So we're very happy to have her here. All right, item I, lobbyist financial disclosure matters. Under the lobbyist, as you know, we mentioned a couple of times, we're in the middle of the registration and reporting season. We'll be sending reminder letters out to lobbyists regarding the due date, which is January 16th. Is that correct, Janet?
The dates are backwards.
Sorry, dates are backwards. January 10th is the deadline, so we've been sending out multiple notices this year. We've done several already. We're going to do another one on Monday, the day before the filing deadline. Filing deadline is Tuesday, and then we'll do one of the day of. And it seems like every time we send out one of these notices, we suddenly get lots of calls. So it's doing its job.
Right. And everyone's doing mandatory e-registering and e-filing.
Right. Yes. Correct. Yep. On the financial disclosure side, we're gearing up for financial disclosure filing season. This year, we have a new idea we're going to try. Last year, agency compliance was an issue where we were having trouble getting agencies to give us their lists of confidential filers. So this year, we're going to try part of the carrot approach, which is instead of the stick, which shaking my fist at them, we're also this year, and we got this from the COGL conference because other jurisdictions were having the same problem, they've come up with a certificate of excellence, which will be provided to all agencies who timely provide to us the lists of their confidential filers, and they were going to post those agencies on our website. It seems that in other jurisdictions, people are fighting for these certificates of good compliance. So we're optimistic that it's going to work here as well.
Supposing we, in addition to that, I mean, I like that idea. Supposing we, because I know we are required to then at some point publish a list of the non-filers. Right? But now it goes in the DC Register. Supposing we did as part of that publication, right, all the agencies that met their because we're not using names, the confidentials, obviously, but we can say in that report that gets published in the DC Register, the following agencies successfully, blah, 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 met their deadline for all confidential filing. And by the way, here are the people, the individuals who didn't file on time. Luckily, that list grows shorter and shorter, but it's an added carrot to that. So I like the idea of rewarding them for moving it forward.
Yeah.
Because no director wants to be you know, seems not being able
to. We also got another great idea from the Kogel Conference. It's a business card size list of the top 10 ethics principles. And it folds over and it fits in your front shirt pocket. And apparently Connecticut, who's been doing this, says that they cannot keep them in stock, that everybody wants one of these. It's a lot cheaper than the ethics manual to produce. And so we would bring them with us to all trainings and make them available that way.
Oh, that's a great idea.
We're getting
a
price right now, you know, for
can't be that expensive.
$1,000, but again, it's much less expensive than
no,
the
I like that manual. Idea very much.
So
also with a hotline number or your number.
Exactly.
Or
kind of thing. So we should have a sample for you at the next meeting.
That's great.
All right. The other item.
I agree to all the above.
The other item on the FDS is the new question for spouses, and I think we've been talking right along about, you know, going in a different path with respect to the amount of money that a spouse makes.
Right.
In fact, we found out at the Kogel conference that that there are actual jurisdictions that find it unconstitutional to require a spouse to report the amount of their income, because the reasoning goes, well, they didn't sign up to be a government employee, it's their spouse who did. So there is the trend out there certainly to not have spouses report the amount of their income.
My recollection is, and the board can correct me if I'm wrong, that we had a very clear consensus that we didn't think, especially because it's in line with what the federal government does, that we don't need to have the amount, the where they work, yes, but not the amount of money that they earn.
So we reached out to our IT vendor to try to get that one question changed.
Right.
And again, doing as little as we have to do with the old system before we can get a new system online.
Right.
But that one does have to be changed. So we will
cut down on the amount of waiver requests.
Yeah, because I think almost all, not all, but almost all of the waiver requests last year were based on questions relating to spousal salaries. Yeah.
Yep. So. Okay. Item J, conflict of interest waivers. Luckily, we don't have any this year pending, or this month pending.
Excellent.
On the non-confidential investigations, I'm going to let Mr. Chanoun talk about we have two cases to discuss. He can talk about the first one.
Good morning and Happy New Year.
You as well.
So this is a case number 1537-001 in Re L. Barksdale. This is a formal investigation involving allegations that the respondent, now former employee of DCRA, pleaded guilty to a federal bribery charge related to her acceptance of cash in return for facilitating the issuance of construction permits. Ms. Barksdale worked at DCRA from June 2001 until June 2012. The offenses occurred in April and May of 2012 as a result of an undercover FBI investigation in which Ms. Barksdale accepted $900. On July 13, 2016, Judge Amit P. Mehta of the United States District Court for the District of Columbia sentenced Ms. Barksdale to 3 years of probation to include 180 days of home confinement and location monitoring based on several factors established by the government. One, Ms. Barksdale's early acceptance of responsibility. Two, her willingness to debrief with the government concerning her conduct. And three, her dependency on drugs and alcohol. The court did not assess any fines or restitution. On December 30th, we interviewed Ms. Barksdale. She confirmed those facts and indicated further that she did not initiate the transactions. She stated that those two instances were the only such instances in which she accepted bribes. Additionally, Ms. Barksdale appeared to be remorseful. She currently works part-time as a permit expediter, in which she describes her duties as pulling permits on behalf of contractors. We recommend the board dismiss this matter as it appears to have been properly resolved in the criminal proceeding.
Right. The permit,
last time we talked about this, you guys wanted us to interview her and find out if there were other instances.
Right. And as I understand it, it was just the two or three that she dealt with the FBI. Is that right?
Yes.
And as my recollection is, this was part of a bigger investigation. She just happened to be a small fish in a bigger pond.
Correct.
Is that right? The only other question I have is she's now a former, obviously, employee of DCRA, the permit expediter. Is she working for a company or on her own?
She
In that capacity, if you know.
The sense that I gathered was she was working on her own.
Okay. But she remains on probation still, so she just pled guilty, so.
Correct.
So she's still under court oversight.
She is.
Okay. And the government didn't lose any money because this was money went in her pocket.
Correct. And that, my understanding is that the federal government got the money back because it was tied to the FBI investigation.
Right. So she didn't make any money off of this. All right. I'm satisfied that a criminal prosecution and conviction for bribery, even with a probationary sentence, is enough to hold her accountable for her misconduct on behalf of the district government. So I would vote to dismiss. Ms. Schwartz?
Me too.
I also vote to dismiss.
Ms. Schwartz? All right. Unanimous.
We have an order. We'll be handing up.
Order. This is a dismissal without prejudice, correct?
Correct. Right. Yeah, I mean, generally speaking, our dismissals are without prejudice unless there's a compelling reason to do so otherwise. Great. Thank you, Mr. Chenoux.
Okay, next item is 1426-001, In re Jaron Price. As you know, the board issued its final decision and final order in this matter on November 29th, 2016. On December 15th, 2016, Mr. Price filed a petition for review of the board's order with the D.C. Court of Appeals. We have yet to receive a copy of the respondent's petition, and no court dates have yet been set.
How is it that we don't have a copy of the petition if he's required to service?
And I think it said that service was made. Is that correct?
Yes, and I guess he served it on Todd Kim, the Solicitor General for D.C. That's what it's got listed on the docket.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah. All right.
I mean, just bring everybody up to speed. The statute says that appeals are to be made to the Superior Court. However, we've been told by the Superior Court that that's not correct, and they're
it's
not
a violation gonna, of the Home Rule Act.
Yeah, they're not going to accept the appeals. So we advised Mr. Price in all good conscience of that, and so it seems that he has properly now filed with the Court of
Appeals.
Yeah,
I'm not surprised that he filed a petition for review, or that he filed it with the Court of Appeals. I'm just a little surprised that we haven't seen it, but. If he served the Solicitor General's office, I guess that's not an illogical place to go.
We'll get a copy of it. Okay, and that's all I have in the public portion.
All right. So at this point, we always make time available for any members of the public to address the board on any matters properly before the board, before we go to a closed session. I just see the usual suspects here today. All right. And in that case, I would entertain and ask for a motion to move us to an executive non-public session to discuss ongoing confidential investigations pursuant to DC Code 2-575B to deliberate on a decision in which the board will exercise quasi-judicial functions pursuant to DC Code 2-575B13 and personnel matters pursuant to DC Code 2-575B10. If I could have such a motion?
So moved.
And second?
Okay.
Moved and second. All those in favor say aye. Aye.
Aye.
Anyone opposed? No. Okay. So before we go off the public record, because we're about to, Mr. Syndrome has walked in. Mr. Syndrome, if you want to address the board, you can have a couple of minutes to do so, but we're about to go to a closed session. And I will remind you for the 84th time, I believe it's 84, I am not a judge. But thank you for, according me the respect.
Public records, you've made application for super court, so.
It was years ago, Mr. Syndrome. Not currently. No.
They have a number of vacancies, actually, I understand.
I'm sure they'll fill them with qualified candidates.
I'm sure one. All right. If I could have the board's indulgence for a moment. Not as organized as you.
Ms. Schwartz is on the phone, by the way, just so that you're aware.
Oh, fine. Oh, which is good. How about if we have, I'm sure you get tired of looking at my toothless, hairless mug. How about if we appear by phone? Seriously. as an ADA accommodation. I have a permanently dislocated kneecap.
You are welcome. Any member of the public is perfectly welcome to appear by phone. We have a system set up so that you can do so.
Yeah?
We do.
So next go around, I can...
Absolutely.
So your ADA man will give me the particulars?
And actually, Ms. Hughes, I think, can help you out how to link in most efficiently. Absolutely.
So soon, I had not mentioned this because we're still working out the kinks. Mm-hmm. We have the ability now to web stream. But we need to make sure
terrific.
That we're able to properly record. So Mr. Sindrum, you may be able to join by phone or by computer, whichever is your...
Well, I happen to be, and thank you, I happen to be serving like a challenge. But by phone, I mean to, as I'm looking at you...
Yeah, we can put you on a conference call.
Perfect.
Same way.
And hello, Councilwoman, how are you? Councilwoman Schwartz?
I'm fine, thank you.
Yeah, you sound well.
Happy New Year. Please.
Likewise, and hopefully the new will be a bit better than the one that passed. It was a tough year.
Right. Okay, Mr. Sindrum, thank you.
There are some issues pending and acted upon. Last go around, I gave you case law about notice and an opportunity to be heard. I've been cut off at the pass by the good executive director here without notice and an opportunity to be heard.
I don't think that's accurate.
And I have, if I may finish, thank you, before you interrupted. There are issues that need to be addressed. Last go around, I was assured Investigator Cook would connect. I haven't heard a word from nobody, and 10 years is not going to cut it. You know, these things need to be addressed in tandem, and they're not. And the reason why, when you see Mike Sindrum and a plethora of cases, is because they're not taken in tandem. They're, you know, collected for a long, long time, and then finally when somebody says, oh, yeah, well, we need to get to it, you know, then something gives. That ought not be. So I need to have access to be able to file. And right now I can't do that. I got to go through a pre-filing hoop unlike anyone else. And I might add, that is violative of the D.C. Human Rights Act. It's setting for me a separate, different standard as opposed to all others similarly situated. You're going to say something, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Sovin, I think we just have a difference of opinion about what exactly the process is for Mr. Sindrum to go ahead and make a formal complaint. So if you wouldn't mind just clarifying it for the record in public.
So I reviewed the correspondence last time, and the only letter that I could find, or the last letter I could find with respect to some sort of a pre-filing prohibition, was a warning to him that if he continued to file frivolous matters with the board, that he was subjecting himself to sanctions under the statute.
That was my recollection. There was no prohibition on him filing, Mr. Sindrum filing any complaint whatsoever. It was an urging and a suggestion that before he do so, he might want to talk to somebody to avoid the possible negative consequences of filing a complaint that ultimately turns out not to be something either within our jurisdiction or meritless. And because of the volume of complaints that had been filed back then, I think the concern was that you were getting a little bit close to the line in terms of the board saying we're spending a lot of time chasing down things that we don't necessarily have jurisdiction over, giving you the opportunity to talk to somebody first to see whether it's even in our bailiwick before you filing it, before some or all of the board decides that this has gone too far. And again, with all due respect, we have very limited jurisdiction over very limited things. And so we are not on a frolic and detour to uncover every wrongdoing in any government agency. We don't have the power to do so, nor should we have the power to do so. The Inspector General has much broader authority than we do on waste, fraud, and abuse and mismanagement. We don't do that. That's not our bailiwick. That's not our score. Excuse me, Mr. Sindrum. And so what I would suggest to you, I say this very pointedly, no one is preventing you from filing any complaint you deem you want to file. No one is. I would urge you to think carefully and to talk to the staff, if you so desire, about what the content of that is going to be, because there are consequences for filing meritless complaints. And so to the extent that your complaint today is that there's some filing bar that's been put in place, there is no bar. And if there is, I hereby remove it to the extent that I have the powers to do so. So you file whatever you want. Again, I will continue to urge you to have a conversation with the investigator, with Mr. Sohn, with somebody about what it is you're about to file, because it does take a lot of time for a small staff to chase things down about what our jurisdiction is. We are not the police force. We are not the inspector general. We are not the attorney general. We only enforce the code of conduct. And so on D.C. government employees and public officials only.
May I?
Not D.C. bar officials. We don't have any authority over them either. Now, Mr.
Sindrum, courts.
you've got, I'm going to give you 2 more minutes and then we have to call this to an end. Bring this to an end.
In the words of Harry Truman, the buck stops here. I understand you have limited resources, limited staffers, but the sum is the whole of its parts, all right? And it's little things that make up the big ones. And when the term is tossed out, frivolous, you know, a large number, this can be misleading and it can be disingenuous. I understand my reputation precedes me, but I am a disabled veteran who served our country more than most. And that ought to muddy the water on a case new, you know, for a fresh pair of eyes to look at. For instance, what gave rise to this danger letter, if you will, coming close to the line in your words, was a situation with the Office of Human Rights, and it was an investigator prior to Mr. Cook, who loved me, and I'm being facetious here, right? And instead of doing the right thing, came after me to make me the bad guy. Now, I have since forwarded a copy of the settlement agreement to Mr. Cook for follow-up. And again, I was assured I'd receive some kind of contact. I haven't. And I did make mention, too, that Office of Human Rights is out of control. The mediation manager, Georgia Stewart, of 50 years, you may know Councilman Schwartz during your tenure, too, that name, was kicked under the bus, terminated because she refused to follow an unethical, unlawful order of Director Monica Palacio, which was the right thing to do. But she suffers now with foreclosure and so on and so forth, being without any source of income, terminated prematurely.
All right, Mr. Sindrum, so your time is up. Here, this is what I'm going to say. I will continue to urge you to reach to the staff. I will urge the staff to have a conversation with you about anything.
As long as they don't bite me, I won't bite them.
So on filing whatever it is, whatever complaint it is that you deem that you want to file. We have rules. We'll follow our rules. We have jurisdiction. We'll follow our jurisdiction, and we'll let the chips fall where they may. So you, by all means, Mr. Sobin doesn't believe there's a bar for you filing anything. I don't believe there's a bar for you filing anything. Mr. Flowers, how about you? You think there's a bar for him filing anything?
No, he's filed within the last six weeks.
Oh, such enthusiasm here. Come on,
Mr. Grimaldi, do you have any reason to believe Mr. Sindrum can't file?
No, sir.
All right. So therefore, you have the leadership of the board and the staff telling you there's no impediment to you filing. File away, Mr. Sindrum. File away.
Thank you.
Thank you. Your time is up. We are now moving to a close.
Clock right, though.
It is 11:56. We're going to move
to
a close. Yep, no problem. We're going to move to a closed session to discuss the matters we identified earlier. We'll go offline and then come back online. All right, so it is now 12:16. We're back on the public record, and we have no further information that came out of the closed session that would be appropriate for the public session. So at this point, we'll go ahead and adjourn the meeting. And our next meeting date is February 9th at 11 a.m. We will see everybody then. Thank you all very much.
Thank you, Chairman.